This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Listen to more of Charlottesville's own public media at sevillepodcast.com. On February 20th, 2008, University of Virginia founder and distinguished statesman Thomas Jefferson addressed the society on a variety of topics.
I must thank you, my friends, for your warm welcome. And I must apologize for what perchance may prove a disappointment to you, insofar as I have never been an adept at public speaking, in which circumstance many of you here present today hold a great advantage over me. My discomfiture in public speaking was such that when it was suggested to me that you all wished to be addressed by a Virginian, no matter what my position having to do with this university was, I considered that perhaps a more appropriate individual to speak to you might be Patrick Henry. You've met him. Well, he is a much better speaker than I ever could hope to be. However, I considered the circumstance, and I realized that while it would be easier to get Mr. Henry to start talking, it would be nearly impossible to get him to stop once he'd begun. And we have a brief time here together this evening. I want to, before I go on, bid you all a hearty and sincere welcome to my university. Do you like it? You are studying and perhaps engaging in other activities at the greatest victory of my late life and one of what I consider to be my three greatest victories in my public life, the battle of my old age, to which I should probably address something. When many of you learned you were going to meet me this evening, perhaps you considered that you may have come into acquaintance with a gentleman who was somewhat superannuated, perhaps a gentleman with a full head of gray hair, or much older than I appear today, wearing perhaps a dark suit. Yes. Well, they make me look very old in those portraits. Some of them. As I stand before you today, you see a man of 30 and 3 years of age. Now, I will be able to address questions from you having to do with all of my life, and to the best of my ability, I shall address them. My only reason that I could possibly give you as to why I chose to appear before you today at such an age as this would be to answer you in the form of a question, a rhetorical question. If any of you, after having had the opportunity to live a long and fruitful life, ever had the chance to come back again, how old would you choose to be? Some of you may not have reached that age yet, I understand. Late in my life, when I was exchanging letters with my friend, and then not so very much friend, and then friend again, John Adams, he asked me a question that was a strange question, but I was used to that from Mr. Adams by that point. He said, if you had it to live over again, would you do it, knowing what you know now? And as is Mr. Adams' want, as is his habit, he jumped right in and answered his own question before giving me a chance. And he said he would, unequivocally. And believe me, he had sacrificed a lot, more than I fear many would be willing to do, both he and his wife and his entire family. And yet he said he would do it again. And I wrote back that I agreed. However, I set one stipulation. I was a lawyer, after all. And that was that I would do it all over again if and only if I could only start not a day before my 21st birthday. Because the years before that, even for me, much too difficult. Many of you perhaps have gone beyond that at this point. Some of you still working on it. And to those of you who are still endeavoring to surpass such an important age in your life, I assure you the best is yet to come. To my inability at speaking in front of crowds, I should say that this was something I never overcame in my life. Those of you who have availed yourselves of the resources here, of the community, which you have here to help to build such skills, I tell you that I encouraged rhetorical study and practice at my university, even though I myself never had skill in it, because I believed that it was essential to the establishment of a government by the people, even though I could not do it much myself. I was so inadequate at it that when I had the terrible ill fortune of being elected the chief executive of the United States of America, and I knew that I had to stand before the legislature and speak to them all, I worked very hard, and I wrote out my speech very carefully. I take pride in my ability to write, at least. And when the day came that I had to stand before the nation's lawmakers, and I held my piece of paper in front of my face, which you shouldn't do, and I read so quietly and mumbled my way through it, some even said that I stuttered, I don't know what they're talking about, that only those lawmakers in the first three or four rows could hear me. The rest could not. But no worry to that effect, because I had already thought of that circumstance, and I had my speech printed, numerous copies of it printed, and I had individuals waiting by the door with prints of my speech to hand out to individuals as they left. I don't have any such print now, so you'll have to do your best with what I give you standing here. And in very short order, that speech had been printed across the world in various languages. After that, though, my experience was so harrowing that after that, not entirely, but to a great deal, I ceased giving speeches as president. I was so bad at it that I wrote my own speeches, but I had someone else read them for me. I hope you never reverse that habit. No matter. I will do my best. I'm glad to see you all out here on such a beautiful evening of such fine Virginian weather, by the way. You braved your way. Some may look at me askance for having referred to it with such nomenclature. I shall tell you, by my own degree, having traveled much more than I ever wanted to, that it is fine because it is Virginian. Should be said of that. Rain here is better than sunshine anywhere else in the world. My ill fortunes in being forced to give yet more speeches in my life when I thought I had perhaps been able to retire from public life, bringing me into the presidency, was the result of travails, of difficulties, of social upheaval in my own personal life that I had never wanted. The election of 1800 was a campaign in a military sense. The disagreements, the public disapprobation was such that by the time of the actual election, men who had known each other for decades and were friends would, when seeing the other one coming their way, cross to opposite sides of the street so as not to be required to tip their hats to one another. Friends who had known each other for years stopped talking to each other. The rift, the serious rift between Mr. Adams and I had begun, to some degree, years before the actual election. But what was printed in the newspapers about the both of us and attributed to either of us placed even more of a wedge between us. The vituperation was insurmountable and beyond calculation. The lies that were spread about us both caused me almost to wonder at my disagreement with Mr. Adams having signed the bills that he signed during his presidency, having to do with the Sedition Act, which some of you may have heard of, the Alien Act. Almost to question that. Would you believe that during the election campaigns of 1800, newspapers actually published that I was an atheist because I would not voice my own personal faith in public? That other newspapers voiced that because I was so against anything, even remotely, having to do with the Judeo-Christian God, that if I were to be elected president, that I would send American forces out to private homes to find people's Bibles, take them and burn them. And when I was elected, so many people did believe this that housewives took their Bibles upon learning of their house Bibles upon learning of my election and buried them or hid them under floorboards in terror for the great scourge that was to come. It was said that I had ceremonies worshiping the goddess of reason, which one would think such ceremonies would be, well, reasonable, but not how they describe them. Descriptions of animal sacrifice and blood and happening in my house, as if I would do that in a home I had worked so very hard on. Well, people will believe almost anything that they read in the newspapers, and they believe that as well. And terrible things were said about Mr. Adams. Also, I shall not repeat them, though, because he would think that I was simply saying them to take one more shot at him. It was never my intent. I did, though, make a decision early on that I would not try to control the press, unlike Alexander Hamilton, who not only controlled the Federalist press, but wrote for it on many occasions. I neither wrote for it nor controlled it. I just chose not to try to curb them, even in their lies. It was my belief that the freedom of the press could only be curbed by the good sense of the people. If you see that a newspaper is being irresponsible, printing lies, not doing their research, well, then it is the duty of the American people to castigate them by simply not purchasing their newspapers. And through their failure as a business, they will learn that that is bad business practice. But if the government were to step in and curb freedom of speech in such a way, then you would put an incredibly powerful influence in the hands of individuals who should never be trusted with very much power. That is to say, politicians. Of which I am one. Of which I am one. I strive to be a statesman. Yet, the fact is, I should hope that future generations of Americans will never assume that about anyone, especially me. And that you will understand, and this is something that I perhaps will cause myself some difficulty over the next 45 minutes or so, when I say that you will understand something that I have ever held close to my heart. That, and this is part of the reason why I was able to withstand the buffets and slings and arrows of the lies in the newspapers all during my presidency, and from previous years as well, without trying to curb them. It is my hope that future generations of Americans will understand that it is not only their right, but that it is their duty to actively, intelligently, and in a civic, civilized manner, totally distrust their elected officials. Especially if you voted for them. Nothing is more dangerous to the survival of liberty in a republic than a trusted elected official. If you don't believe me, just ask Brutus or Cato. They will tell you all about it. Of course, one of the reasons for my saying this is because I believe that when the American public or when any people begin to trust their elected officials, they stop watching them. They stop paying attention to what they are doing. And hence they stop being the only safeguards that ever could be of their own liberty. And that is, of course, important without ability to evaluate, beyond calculation. However, there's another reason why I believe it is your duty to watch over your elected officials so jealously. It is your duty, in addition to protecting your own liberty with your vigilance, to protect and preserve the morals of your elected officials. Here's what I mean. All men, are susceptible to the temptations that are part and parcel with power. And all power is tempting. I know this. I'm a slave owner. It is impossible to separate the two. Men are social, though, by nature, especially men who enter into the political realm. Their ambition, to a large degree, relies, especially in a government by the people, upon the approbation of their neighbors, of their friends. They seek this. If a man believes that he is not being watched, he will not be caught. He is much more likely to succumb to the temptations of power because he thinks, quite, well, simply, he can get away with it. But if you, as citizens, let them know that you are watching them, if you write them letters questioning them about their decisions, if you pay attention to how they vote, pay attention to the newspapers and call them to task too if they stray from strict truth, if you ask them questions, especially the ones they don't want to answer, but those questions that have to do with their public activities, which are so important, if you require proof and reason from them, they may be annoyed with you. They may be angry at you. They may call you names. They may call you gadfly, but great men have been called that. But you must remember that when they react as such, they are as if drunk, because power is intoxicating to all men, none excepted. This is why you must have strict limits upon the reign of your elected officials, so that they inevitably will return to their homes and leave that onus of responsibility that is power in a republic behind them. Because they may not realize it while they are bowed under that terrible weight, but when you are annoying them, you are helping them. If you are doing so responsibly, I don't mean calling them names and throwing things at them, what the Federalists do. No, I don't mean that. I mean paying attention, especially to those with whom you disagree. and not cutting them off, listening until they have completed the thought. And the more you disagree with that thought, that should be the more reminder that you must listen to understand what they are trying to say and the reasons behind it. And while you annoy them, to listen to what they are trying to do and then voicing your disagreement. Truth is stubborn. If you calmly and reasonably express it, it will stand the test of every disapprobation of power. Eventually, if you stand firm in this, those men who might have cursed you under their breath, or not so much under their breath, while they were distracted by the reins of power, when they do return home, they will thank you. Because when they return home and they are able to slough off those terrible weights, that terrible burden that is power in a republic, they will return home and you will be their neighbors, their friends, their brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, their fathers, perhaps, even in a day I cannot imagine, when they return home, you may be their husbands, or you may be, etc. When they finally do return home and they recover, and they realize what you have done for them, they will thank you. Because with your vigilance, you will have helped them resist those temptations of power. And they will shake your hand, because with your activity, your intelligence, your education, and your stubbornness, you will have enabled them when they return home to hold their heads high and look you in the eye and smile when they meet you on Sunday in church, perhaps, or on Thursday in a marketplace. Because they will finally realize at that point that when they return home, you will have hopefully successfully assisted them in protecting something that is more valuable than all of the emoluments of power combined, their sacred honor. After all, my friends, so many have not sacrificed so much to protect your right to agree with your government, now have they? Even a tyrant will allow you to agree with him. Our government strives for much more than that. Now, having said that, I realize I have now caused myself a bit of a problem, because I have just said that right before inviting you to ask me questions. I suspect that I shall be the only, or one of the only, elected officials who will ever do this for you. The rest very likely will shudder at such opportunities, or, in the case of Mr. Henry, just talk so long that you have no time left at the end of the questions. But we discussed this before I arrived here this evening, and I agreed with my friends who have brought me here that the students here are of such a level of curiosity and intellect that they would, yes, I know, flattery will get you everywhere, that the majority of the time being dedicated to questions from you may prove much more valuable than any time I might spend wandering here and there, talking about this and that. Later in his life, John Quincy Adams said of me that we spent a lot of time together in France, the Adamsons and I, and John Quincy was like a son to me. Spoke with him for hours, a bright, bright boy. And, well, he turned out to be much more than that. He said of me much later that when I talked, I tended to go from this subject to that, and wander here and there, and skip about, not really keeping any particular line of thought. And I suspect in the 20 minutes or so that I've spoken now, you've already seen that. So with that in mind, what I'm going to do now is one of my favorite things.